Hello and welcome to Steppin' Out, where you will hear the inspiring stories of those who are able to heal from their struggles with insurmountable difficulties. And now, Steppin' Out.
Welcome to Steppin' Out Radio. I'm Denise McEntee, your host, where on every program you hear two stories of people that have overcome tremendous adversity in their lives. But the good news is they come on this show and share with you their experience, strength, and hope, and how they turn their lives around. And 99.9 times, everybody's life isn't perfect, but boy, is it changed, and they're living, you know, these wonderful lives. And the woman you're about to meet is one of those. She's a fantastic young woman. She's a journalist, an editor, an author, a storyteller, a native New Yorker, and she has always had the unreasonable notion that she can help change the world. And I loved when I read that line. That's a great line, because you, all of us can change the world. She's the author of a memoir, and I want you to write this down because I read it. You don't have to be from New York to have it resonate with you, although I am from New York and we do the show from New York. But we all can resonate with what happened on 9/11 or even just with PTSD. And that's, you know, you didn't have to live in New York. We're still living with PTSD. So she wrote this incredible book called After 9/11, One Girl's Journey Through Darkness to a New Beginning. Her name is Helena Hovitz, and she also got sober at the tender age of 22, which if you're listening, can offer you so much hope. If you're young, and she could tell you, you know, you could still have fun in sobriety, or if you're a parent of a loved one, or, you know, you don't have to wait till you're my age to get sober. So I'd like to give a great big Steppin' Out Radio welcome to Helena Hovitz, H-O-V-I-T-Z. And I want to give out her website. It's HelenaHovitz.com, and Helena spelled a little different. It's H-E-L-A-I-N-A-H-O-V-I-T-Z, HelenaHovitz.com. And again, you can get her book on Amazon and Barnes & Noble directly from her website. So check it out. It's really a great read because she's an awesome writer. So Helena, welcome to Steppin' Out Radio.
Thank you so much for having me and for that wonderful introduction.
Yeah, I like to highlight all the great things people do because it wasn't always so great, right? And on Steppin' Out, we usually begin at the person's beginning in how, you know, maybe their, you know, their struggle started, let's say. So what happened to you? You know, what was your beginning?
Absolutely. So really, I think the place where it makes the most sense to start the story is, as you mentioned, on 9/11. It's a very intense and involved story, so I'm going to give the radio version.
It's okay.
So I went to school and lived a few blocks from the World Trade Center, and I was 12 years old on 9/11. And I think, you know, we've had some distance. It's been almost 20 years, but even at the time and even now, people don't realize that people were living and going to school. There were children. There were people who, you know, it wasn't just somewhere people worked. And so we were all in school. And essentially what happened to me was when the school was evacuated, which it was by the bomb squad, my neighbor who I walked to school with every day had offered to take me home. And we didn't know, of course, now in hindsight, we know how it unfolded, but we didn't know what was happening or what was going to happen. And at the time, you know, my mom worked further uptown in the city. My dad worked in another borough. And my grandparents, who were in their 80s, lived in the same apartment building as us. So the thought, there was no question that, okay, we just need to get home, which was normally a 10-minute walk to the other side of Lower Manhattan, and get to my grandparents, and then my parents will know where to find me. And unfortunately, we all know what happened was that the second tower was hit, the first tower collapsed, the second tower collapsed, and we were in the middle of it just literally a couple of blocks away the entire time. So we spent an hour covered in ash and crying and running. And the things that we saw, I mean, there's things that we've seen on the news and things that, you know, we've seen. There's no words to describe the things that we saw and what was happening to people and happening around us and just that fear that we were going to die. And we didn't even know it was happening. We didn't know they were planes. We didn't know they were collapsing. Like, I just thought the world was ending and I was never going to see my parents or grandparents again. And the reason it took us an hour to get home was because there was so much chaos that, you know, the police weren't letting people in. They were only trying to get people out. And our only option for us was to get in and to get home and make sure my grandparents were okay and alive and like try to. So we finally, we made it, but we were in the street for all of that chaos. And we did make it home. Eventually, my mom made it home later that night. My dad didn't. And the horrifying thing was, you know, we were in the building. We lost power. We lost water. We lost, it was basically an abandoned ghost town with the tower still on fire, with dust in the apartment. And the police told everyone that our apartment complex had been evacuated, but we hadn't. And so you had hundreds and hundreds of people. Some of them were elderly. Some of them are in wheelchairs. I mean, there were kids. We were pretty much just stranded in this war zone with no one to help us.
Wow.
Because they were telling everyone we were in holding shelters, and we weren't. And so my dad got home the next day, and, you know, it was a whole new thing. I mean, the rest of the world kind of was, or the rest of the city even, like, was, you know, the mayor got on TV and said, let's get back to normal. I mean, down here, there was no normal. It was every hour there was a new warning of a building falling, or, you know, people were running and screaming. I mean, the outside, it was just like a dust storm. I mean, we didn't have phones. We didn't have access to food. It was just terror and chaos. And it went on like that. Our school didn't resume for 2 weeks. And so it was basically just living in fear, and with the early signs of and symptoms of what I now know with post-traumatic stress disorder. And, you know, eventually the school was relocated, but Lower Manhattan, I mean, for us living here, some of my classmates who lived in Battery Park on the side of the island of the city where the towers were, they were living from hotel to hotel because everything in there, they couldn't go home for months. Their stuff had been destroyed. The school couldn't go back for months because the air quality was so dangerous. And the irony of that, unfortunately, is we were still living down here. So we, you know, even though the school was relocated a little further uptown, we were still in a war zone. And what was happening was, I mean, we were a bunch of traumatized kids then put into a situation that was more traumatic, where we went to a school building where there were already three other schools. It was crowded. It was chaotic. Like, every time we heard a siren or a loud noise, half of us started freaking out. I mean, it was pretty bad. So,
and you also were an only child too. So, right? So you couldn't even go home and share it with a sibling, you know? It's very frightening. Yeah. And your parents, tried to help you, I'm sure. But, you know, you're of a different age. You're probably at one of the worst ages, I think, because my girls were 5 when it happened. They were, you know, you could shield them more towards it, and they weren't in the school like you. It's devastating. Yeah, you must have thought you were, God knows what you thought. It's harrowing. So what happened next?
Yeah, so, you know, when you're 12, that's kind of, you know, you have these two points in your life where you detach as a kid, right? One is like when you're really tiny and you start to try to figure out the world and your independence. And then the other is when you're like 12 or 13, right? Because that's when we start to develop who we are at the onset of adolescence. And that's when our brain starts to process things, and our body, like, that's when we really start to figure out, you know, our interpretation of the world and who we are in it. And for something like that to happen at that critical time, growing up after that as a teenager was like absolute hell, because we tried to get help for what I was going through, for issues that were really prevalent. And I went from therapist to therapist to psychiatrist to a different doctor, and I got all these different diagnoses and different medications, and I was told that I was bipolar, and I was told I had ADHD, and I was told I was manic depressive. And, you know, the worst part was that, like, you know, I wanted to get better. At the same time, my symptoms were getting worse. They were getting more complex. And being a teenager, like, you already are dealing with so much stuff, and it just intensified that experience. And, you know, it was awful because it was almost even more traumatic to have these doctors say, here's what's wrong with you. You'll get better if you, you know, take these pills or do this thing. And not only was it not helping, but I would get really sick. And I was also kind of making a bigger mess of my life without knowing it. And, you know, on the outside, though, I held it together. Like, school was always really important to me. I ended up bouncing around from school to school. But as I got older, like 16, 17, 18, that's when, you know, what do teenagers do? They experiment with drugs and drinking, right?
Right.
And so I actually didn't drink. You know, I was still kind of in the experimentation phase at like 16, 17. I would say like when I got to college, there was this kind of intersection where things were really, really bad. And I started to kind of smoke weed every day. And it was kind of like then still doing its job as like a little escape, right? And so I went to college.
Did you go to school in New York City?
I stayed in the city for a few reasons. One is because I was still way too scared to venture out further into the world. Like it might sound silly to folks who this might be kind of a new kind of issue. But it's when you are so terrified of all these things in the world around you that you can't predict, and you have faced losing the potential of losing your parents and your family, and you want to stick close by. And so fortunately the college I went to was the New School, and they allowed me to declare journalism like my first year because I knew that's what I wanted to do. So for several reasons I was in the city, and so I entered college and I was like, okay, this is going to be a promising new beginning, but you know, wherever you go, there you are, whether it's across the country to college or on a few stops on the subway. And I was just so exhausted from, I had finally entered into in my second semester of college, I was actually like really close to, taking my own life, because I thought it's just never going to get better. And I'm trying everything and I'm trying so hard, but I reached out and I finally found the right kind of therapy, and it was cognitive behavioral therapy. And she didn't tell me outright at the time, but she knew it was post-traumatic stress disorder. And I've since spoken to her for the book, and she's like, you know, at the time when you were 18, 19, you know, I didn't know if you could hear it. We had so much work to do. And so we started to face things for recovery that were really difficult and really painful and were a lot of work. So at the same time that I was finally making progress, I was also starting to drink more. And it was still socially, but it was like, why does anyone pick up a drink, right? It's to relax. It's to unwind. You had a hard day. Like, it's so common in our, in society. And also, I was in college. And so it might not have been like the kind of college where there's keg parties, right? Because I'm in the city. But what I was doing was I was going to these high-end clubs with, like, I guess I knew the right people from growing up in the city, right, quote-unquote, the right people. And, you know, we would go to these clubs where, like, a table the size of a coffee table was, like, someone paid $10,000 for it. That was not me. And we were, quote-unquote, hot girls. And so we went in and we drank for free and we danced on the tables and there were celebrities there. And it was, once or twice a week. And it wasn't a big deal. And I didn't think it was a big deal. And the drink, and it was like, gave me this sense of like, finally, I feel kind of normal, or like I'm worth something, or like I'm silencing all the mental chatter that comes with not only still dealing with a mind that is kind of riddled with these, traumatic, neurological pathways, but also just the, it's really hard to change your behavior and do things that feel new and scary. And so it was like, turning off the thoughts now, drinking, great, And I think that kind of went on that way. And as I continued to recover through college, I then started seeing a dialectical behavioral therapist, which kind of builds on CBT, DBT. These are totally Googleable things. But essentially, it's adding even more wonderful skills and coping tools and, like, mindfulness to the, relearning the ways of processing thoughts, reacting, perceiving information, looking at your facts and feelings, figuring out really how to start over and, like, develop healthy ways of thinking and being and feeling and talking that I didn't get the chance to do when I was 12. And again, these things were exhausting. They were difficult. I was still very emotionally reactive. And so I was still drinking and smoking weed. And I didn't see it as a problem because I still graduated college with a 3.8 GPA and had a byline in a local newspaper and the New York Times and an internship. Like, I was, the word alcoholic didn't even...
Right, on paper, you looked... Yeah, it looked great.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I
wasn't... So there wasn't a little voice in your head that thought, Helena, maybe I do drink a little more than the average person, but I guess you were so young, you were looking around and people were doing it, right?
Yeah. It became harder as I got closer to graduating college and as I did more and more, as I made more and more progress around the PTSD and all the issues, really becoming an adult in the world and dealing with things that were difficult. Mostly a lot of it were things that were out of my control or triggered anxiety, relationship, things like that. Mm-hmm. But that were very intense. I still felt things intensely. And so I was working on that. And the more self-awareness I had and the more that I was able to make progress, the more clear it became, to a point where in my last year of college, my therapist was like, just so you know, when you have an emergency or you feel like you're in a crisis, right, now it's at the point where that's pretty much happening mostly when you're not sober. And I was like, that's nice. And moving on, because I wasn't ready. I was like, great observation. So here's what else. And, you know, she believed that I needed to come to it on my own, which I did very shortly after I graduated college, because it became very apparent to me that little voice was good. There was a little voice, and it popped up, and it got louder and louder, because I could, while I could go for weeks or, you know, stretches of time without drinking, I could have one or two. Like, I, you know, there's this image that I think we still have in society that we're working on improving, as the alcoholic is like, you know, a 50-year-old woman who keeps a bottle in her desk and she drinks in the morning and she puts it in her coffee, or it's someone who, like, drinks and drives and gets thrown in jail. Like, we have all...
Right, or they're under a bridge, homeless. Right.
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 Which is so... Or they're still...
And you were very functional. That's where it becomes very cunning, right, and baffling, because you were functional. Who gets a 3.8?
Absolutely.
You know?
Absolutely.
Like, yeah. Gosh, if you weren't drinking, what would you get? You know, like, it's unbelievable. So,
yeah, and so it was really bumping up against all this work I was doing in recovery.
But you know what's a good thing, Helena, and I'm sorry for interrupting you, but you sound like you were, and, you know, I interview and talk to so many different people, and they never really would tell their therapist the truth. Like, it's like, oh, yeah, maybe I have 3 or 4 drinks, you know. But it sounds like you really bared it all. So that was, you know, I'm just putting it out there to people that, you know, what do they say? You're only as sick as your secrets, so don't keep those secrets in. Right? So you were pretty honest with your therapist, right?
Oh, yeah. And, you know, it's funny because my dad, when I was very little, he's like a wonderful man with wonderful values, and he instilled them all in me. And so I honesty was actually something I held, you know, was always very important to me. And I knew, you know, from little tidbits he gave me when he was little, like, if you cheat on your homework, you're only cheating yourself. And so, like, if I was like, all right, I need help. So if I hold anything back, I'm not going to get better. And I approached therapy and sobriety, when I found it, with so much enthusiasm that I think people were almost a little surprised by it, because sometimes people don't want to ask for help. They don't want to call their sponsor. They don't want to call their therapist. And I was like, help, 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 to a point where it was almost maybe a little too enthusiastic. But it was all to my benefit.
No, but it was great. It was great that you did that. You know, and you found therapists, too, that were awesome in giving you their cell numbers. And
finally,
and I'm putting that in email addresses, and I'm putting that out there, too, because, you know, if you're not comfortable with a therapist, try to find another one, right? Like that you connect with. Because it sounded like you had good ones and bad ones, and the good ones really helped you.
Oh, God. Yeah. To anyone who feels like they're not with the right fit right now, give it a little time. And if it still feels like you're not, you're probably not. But don't give up, because there are people in every field who just might not be a fit for. Like, there are doctors who are bad at their jobs. There are hairstylists who are bad at their, like there's the problem in everywhere you go. And it's so, you know, so much more impactful when it's a therapist, because your mental health and your emotions are the most precious thing you have. And so it can be really easy to get discouraged there, or feel, you know, like you want to shut down or stop. But, like, please keep looking until you find the right person, because I promise you the right person is there. I found them finally.
Right. And that's the same for a meeting. You know, if you go to a meeting, I've had people on the show say, you know, when they first tried to get sober, they went to a meeting and people were a little aloof, which rarely happens. So don't think that happens in meetings. It's actually quite the opposite. But for some reason, or she said it could have even been in my own head, because I was I was scared. So she went to sit down, and the woman said, oh, I'm sorry, that seat's saved. And she thought, that's it. It's just like middle school. I'm out of here. And she goes, drank for like 10 more years. And if only I would have tried another meeting. Like, my friend finally said to me, well, why don't you try another meeting? And she goes, and then the second one, I fell in love. But, you know, I could have saved myself a lot of heartache. So if at first you don't succeed, right, try again because you
will. Oh, yeah. And you know what? If you want to get better, no one is going to push you out of that seat in the therapist chair. No one's going to push you out of that meeting, like in my experience, because I almost got pushed out a bunch. Like when I first went, so I found my first meeting 6 months after I graduated college, because by that time I had decided that despite my best efforts,
Yeah, what was your defining moment? You said you led us up to like your last year of college, and your therapist, you know, wisely said to you, "Well, it seems like every time you drink is when you fall apart." So, what was that defining moment of when you stopped or went to a meeting? Or how did that look?
Totally. So I had that little voice, like I think I mentioned this a little bit earlier. But as a storyteller, I will accidentally tell you 10 stories when I'm trying to get to one. So I had that little voice that was like, hey, I bet you like most 21-year-olds like don't go to the hospital with alcohol poisoning 4 times before they graduate college, things like that. And so I tried to stop it on my own. Like AA, like no sort of recovery or written, like nothing was mentioned to me. I thought I just have to control it. And so I would have these stretches of controlling it. And then finally, really, like my quote unquote bottom was just one night too many of, like, I think it was one of the first times, if not the first time, I blacked out and I just woke up. I got very sick after drinking. Like people wake up and drink to cure a hangover. Like I was like convulsing and throwing up with a migraine for like 12 hours the next day. Like I got very sick. Like I woke up, I looked around, like my boyfriend at the time was like, how much longer are you going to keep doing this to yourself? Like, don't even worry about me. Let's not even talk about what you did to me last night. Like, and I just texted my therapist and it must've been in my head from something. And I think it was a book that I had read. I think it was Drinking a Love Story by Carolyn Knapp. And I remember like reading it and underlining it like, this is me. But it didn't occur to me. Like but at that moment it must've been waiting to just be woken up, because I texted my therapist. I was like, do you know of any meetings where people under like 50 go to? And like, do they have those? And she's like, yeah, I know someone who can tell you. And I went to my first meeting. I told my story. I raised my hand. I was like, I'm new. And I got everyone's numbers. And I was like, this is great. Where were you all when I was in high school and I couldn't keep friends? And
you weren't alone in that one. I'm sure everyone in the room had the same issue. That's, you know.
But
it's painful. Yeah. So they embraced you, right?
They did, and I embraced it back. Like, I would call my sponsor and be like, Steph works down early. Like, I had tried to do it on my own, and I know to say for so long over the course of, like, I guess, like, 4 years doesn't sound like that long, but I was just, like, so relieved that there was a way. I was thrilled. And so I didn't drink again. I didn't smoke weed again after that. It's been almost 8 years for me now.
Oh, that's beautiful.
And I will say, talking about like owning your seat, like I ran into some trouble in my early days with like sponsors and stuff, because people were telling me that I shouldn't be on medication. And people had a problem with medication. So like, if I had to try really hard not to let myself get pushed out, because could you imagine you're like in early sobriety and you're like, doing all the things and someone's like,
I can't work with you. Yeah.
You should take this sleeping pill for your insomnia. I was like, what? That doesn't have to do with anything. But thank goodness I had like my therapist, and I had a couple of older mentor type figures in the program who were like, no. Like there are some people in here telling you things that they shouldn't be.
And that wasn't a trigger for you. Right. Everybody has to find what works for them. Right. So that must have been hard. How did you deal with that? You just were diligent in finding someone else, right?
Yeah, and I had to go through several. It was like the same thing again with the therapist. Like I had to find a sponsor who understood, and I finally did. And it's not that she and I didn't butt heads, because like we did, but she taught me. I mean, that was the beginning of becoming the person I am today. Of just really, that was the last piece of the puzzle with all this recovery I'd been doing and making peace with fears and resentments and, you know, ways of behaving that all started, some of them started on 9/11, a lot of them started after, some of them came as the result of operating from a place of being fearful and triggered and making bigger, you know, messes and making bad choices to try and feel better temporarily, you know, like it's so complex. And some of it was like from when I was younger, like my seventh grade teacher didn't believe I was sick and I was still carrying that with me. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
Like all these things.
Right.
And yeah, yeah.
But you worked through it. And we only have like a couple of minutes left. I could talk to you for another hour. But what's your life like now? You know, and I know you're kind of describing what it's like now, but it's 8 years sober. What's your life like now, Helena?
Yeah. So, you know, I've figured out, you know, the things that I need to do to kind of keep myself, you know, very mentally healthy and calm and happy. And, you know, I've become, you know, the person I could never dream that I would have been when I was sitting in my room at 18 crying and crying and thinking, you know, what's my life going to be? You know, I have friends that I've had for years and years, which I never thought I'd have. I have a husband who is the best. I know everyone says this, but really, he is the best guy in the world. He's kind and thoughtful and supportive. And
like your dad.
Yeah, go figure, right? And I have a healthy relationship, and I trust him, and I trust people again. And that's not to say that I'm just, you know, floating on a cloud, like you said, and life is never, ever stressful, and nothing bad has ever happened again. But I feel that I've found purpose, and I've found, you know, happiness, and I've found serenity, and it helps me to be the person I want to be in the world and do the things I want to do. And I'm able to actually do that because of all the years of work cleaning out all these old behaviors and old concepts through the process of recovery.
And so that's tremendous. It's so great for young people to hear it too. Well, I want to thank you so much. Okay, you're listening. I'm Denise McEntee, the host of Steppin' Out Radio. To hear more stories like Helena's, go to steppinoutradio.com. Sign up for our free newsletter. Like us on Facebook, and we'll let you know new stories that are coming up or maybe some seminars we're going to have. And I want to give out Helena's website as well so you can look at all the work she's done. And she's a prolific writer. And the way you wrote the book, too, was beautiful. Like, I felt like, you know, I felt like I was there. You're a gifted writer. So her website is www.helenahovitz.com. And I'll spell Helena, HelenaHovitz, HelenaHovitz.com. And grab her book because you'll love it. After 911, One Girl's Journey Through Darkness to a New Beginning. Helena, thank you so much and continued success on your journey.
Thank you so much for having me.
Okay, have a great day. Take care.